Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
so, don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia? We're back for another Green Power Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman. I'm talking to you from Santa Rosa, California, at the True North, Health Center. I got to tell you, I just had my first glass of juice after a 16-day water fast. I dropped... Well, last June I weighed 193 pounds and now I weigh 148. My friends are asking me if I look like Gandhi. I do think I'm a little taller than Gandhi was. I'm not sure, but I do think so. We have a great program today on health and wellness. We are joined by two wonderful doctors, Dr. Alan Goldhammer. Alan, are you with us?
I am.
Good, good, good. Alan Goldhammer is the founder and head of the True North Health Clinic, where I'm talking to you from, and Dr. Nathan Gershfeld. Nathan, are you there?
Hi, Harvey.
How are you? Everything's good.
We are actually doing very well. Thanks for having us.
I'm happy to, honored to have you actually, and I'm very happy. I'm coherent, but barely. If I sound a little tired, it's because I haven't eaten in 16 days until this morning when I was brought a beautiful glass of watermelon juice with something green in it. Can you guys tell me what was in that juice?
That would have been watermelon celery juice.
Watermelon celery juice was fantastic, and I'm having a wonderful time here. I'm actually going to be here another week. It's a spectacular place. First, before I lose track, I have some sad news to relate. The great Ernest Callenbach, author of Ecotope, passed away. He had cancer. I wish that his treatment had gone differently. He was in his 80s. He looked like he was in his 50s. I did a talk with him a few years ago, which is on my website, harveywasserman.ning.com, from Ecotopia to Solartopia. He was a wonderful man, passed away in Berkeley, California. A tremendous loss to us all. And, you know, it underscores the importance of health and diet and so many other things about food that are critical to our continuing lives in a society that is inundated with really, really bad toxic food and air and water. So I'd like, Alan, Dr. Goldhammer, you are the you have been involved with raw food and with natural food, organic food, and a vegan diet for many, many years. Maybe you can tell us how many. And can you give us, please, the essence of what's so important about a vegan diet?
Well, I've been doing this work for over 30 years now. And, you know, our basic premise is that health is the result of healthful living. And obviously an important part of healthful living is healthful eating. And we advocate a diet that's both vegan and also what we call SOS-free. And SOS stands for sugar, oil, and salt. It's also the international warning symbol. But
well, it seems fitting.
Avoiding animal foods in the diet obviously has tremendous advantages. Today, the world that we live in is not the world of our ancestors. And so animal foods suffer a fundamental problem, which is biological concentration. So all of the various and sundry products that occur in the environment that shouldn't be there will build up in animal tissues as those animals live in that world over the course of their lifetime. And so a calorie of animal food may have anywhere from 10 to 1,000 times the concentration of various toxic substances that you might find in, say, a calorie of plant-based foods.
And that, as opposed to SOS, which is sugar, oil, and salt, that would be SAD, the standard American diet.
Absolutely.
So continue, please.
By avoiding this biological concentration of materials, we eliminate a large percentage of the exposure that humans get currently to everything from PCB and dioxin to heavy metal contamination, et cetera. It also turns out that although we're equipped to handle animal products in small quantities, our biology does not allow us to eat unlimited quantities of these products without paying a price. And so,
let's back up one moment here. You talked about all the toxic metals and chemicals and pesticides and so on that are in the meat eaten by, in the standard American diet, or SAD. One question that we don't want to lose track of, what about organic meat? What about range-fed meat?
Yeah. Well, meat that's raised without the addition of large amounts of antibiotics and chemical stimulants would obviously have an advantage over those that are raised conventionally in commercial feedlots. But the next problem with animal foods, besides just the biological accumulation of toxins, is the fact that excess fat or excess protein turns out to be quite detrimental to human beings and is responsible for much of the cardiovascular disease as well as kidney disease and is associated with diabetes and cancer.
All right, can you tell us how?
Just
how does meat cause these diseases?
Excuse me?
How does meat cause these diseases?
Well, there's probably a number of mechanisms that have been identified and involved, but essentially the essence comes down to that you can only process so much concentrated foods, particularly foods high in nitrogenous waste products. For example, if you eat more nitrogenous-rich foods than you can handle, it overloads the kidney's adaptive capacities. You end up with kidney disease, the associated hypertension, and then the resulting cardiovascular disease. If you get exposure to too much fat, it can contribute to the fatty buildup inside the vessels that's associated with the little clots that form secondary to atherogenesis and the resulting cardiovascular disease and also reduction in circulation to the rest of the organs of the body. So,
all right, so if someone goes on a largely vegan diet,
mm-hmm.
how much organic meat or fish, and maybe we could discuss the difference between the two, can they safely or healthily eat?
Well, if you look at epidemiological data, people that eat very small quantities of animal food in general, 6 ounces a week or less, for example, it's very difficult to tease apart a difference between, say, the vegans and the people that eat very small quantities. So it's possible that people can eat small quantities and get away with it. Now, just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you should do something. And even if you set aside the moral, ethical, and spiritual issues that some people raise regarding animal food intake, the fact is every time you take animal foods into your diet, you're playing a little bit of Russian roulette. You're taking a little bit of a chance. You don't know if that particular mouthful of food is going to have the prions that later will manifest as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or mad cow disease. You don't know if that mouthful will push you over the threshold, for example, with fish particularly, of mercury, what accumulates over biological time in your body. So, you know, that can be an issue. You don't know if that's going to be the issue that will be associated with your threshold in terms of clotting factors that will result in a little plaque breaking free and creating the stroke or heart attack that pushes you over the edge. So although, yes, people can eat small amounts of animal food and not see obvious short-term difference, I think that it is always a little bit of a risk factor. In the case of animal foods in general, if you don't cook it enough, you can die. I think Jack in the Box proved that not too many years ago when a bunch of people passed away because somebody didn't quite cook their feces-contaminated meat enough to kill off the bacteria that was associated with its contamination.
Okay, so we've talked, that's convincing enough for me. So we understand why meat is bad. Tell us now, please, what makes a vegan diet so positively powerful?
Well, the benefit to a vegan diet, in essence, is that you've eliminated the meat, fish, fowl, eggs, and dairy products that are associated with dietary excess. So assuming you also make it an SOS-free diet, you eliminate the causes of the difficulties that people are having in our society. You eliminate the obesity, you eliminate much of the type 2 diabetes, the cardiovascular disease, and you reduce dramatically your risks of cancer, the breast, prostate, lung, and colon. Because this is one of the essence causes of these disabilities.
Okay, let's back up. I do have an advantage here in that I have heard you talk, both you and Dr. Gershfeld talk a number of times, and so Like a good lawyer, which I'm not, you know, we ask questions and we know the answer. Let's back up just a little bit. Can you differentiate, please, between meat, chicken, and fish?
Well, you know, they're really a lot more similar than they are different. It's kind of like if you ask somebody, would you rather die from burning to death or drowning? You know, they're slightly different experiences, but the end result is essentially the same.
Well, I'll take drowning, but that's okay.
And, yeah, maybe that's true. The fact is some meats like fish, for example, have a slightly different ratio of essential fatty acids that might be perceived as more favorable, but they tend to be biological accumulators of toxins such as mercury.
Now, that would be omega-3, or is it 6? 6 is the best.
The omega-3 fatty acid ratios are a little higher in the fish than it might be, say, in the beef or something, and as a consequence, that may be perceived as advantageous.
And what about chicken?
You know, it's interesting. With chicken, particularly commercially raised chicken, if you just ask any chicken farmer whether they'd eat chicken, you may be surprised at the disgust that they'll express when they start explaining that they never eat chicken. But you know, you can argue that just like with beef, you could have free-range chickens that are not tortured all their life, kept in unsanitary and inhumane conditions, and then killed and eaten. You could do the same thing with chickens. You could raise them more naturally, and they probably would be less undesirable in terms of consuming them.
Dr. Gershel, do you want to jump in here and add anything, please?
Yeah, you know, I noticed, I really picked up something that you said earlier, and you said you were questioning whether omega-3 is good or omega-6 is bad. And I think that's a really underlying issue with people's misunderstanding of nutrition. It's not that one thing is bad or one thing is good. It's that we're trying to achieve a balance of mostly healthy foods. Now, today in this country, 7% of our caloric intake comes from fruits and vegetables.
How much?
About half.
70%?
70.
Okay.
No, 7.0. Excuse me.
Oh,
7%. That means most of that is coming from French fries, potatoes, and ketchup.
Oh, what you're saying, sorry, let's back up. What you're saying is that 7% of our nutrition is coming from vegetables.
Vegetables and fruits.
And what should it be?
It should be about 95%. What we're doing is...
No, wait. So 7% of our fruits, of our diet, the standard American diet, SAD, is fruits and vegetables, 0.7. And you're saying it should be 90?
7.0.
Oh, 7.0%, right?
93% of calories come from animal foods or pleasure trap chemicals, oil, flour, sugar, salt, these products.
We're going to have to discuss the pleasure trap later, but we have 7%. This is pretty staggering here. You're saying that we have the standard American diet, the average American, and by the way, in one of your lectures, and I will put this out, you said that 80%, that's 80% of Americans are overweight. Is that correct?
No, it's two-thirds. 66% of Americans are overweight.
Exaggerated. 66% of Americans are overweight.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay, so 7% of the standard American diet is fruits and vegetables, and you're saying it should be what percent?
Well, fruits and vegetables, grains and beans should represent virtually all the calories that people consume instead of 7%.
So you're figuring this percentage based on calories, calorie intake.
Of course. In other words, people should be eating whole natural foods, fruits, vegetables, minimally processed grains, beans, and raw nuts and seeds, and that's it. They shouldn't be eating meat, fish, fowl, eggs, dairy products, oil, salt, and sugar. Those foods those products should be eliminated.
Should we make them illegal?
I don't think we need to make them illegal. I think we just need to educate the public so they understand the fact that what they've been told is not accurate or true. I think that we need to elect people into public office that instead of providing heavy federal subsidies for products like milk products, for example, where they require that every child in public schools be given exposure to this product, which may be one of the more detrimental products that we're given, that we stop that kind of nonsense. The fact is, that 80% of black folks, for example, don't contain the enzyme lactase in order to be able to digest milk products at all, and yet we require that every child, whether they have the necessary biology or not, be given this product as a part of their federally subsidized food programs.
All right, well, let's stop here again. Now, we have a full hour here, so we're going to do this methodically. Dr. Allen, what is wrong with milk? here, everybody in the country, or 90% of the country, thinks that milk is this wonderful, wholesome, nutritious substance that provides calcium and without which children would never get healthy. So tell us, please, what is your opinion of milk?
There's a lot of problems with milk. One of the things that we've recognized is that in genetically vulnerable children that are exposed to whole milk products, they can develop a condition called type 1 diabetes, where the body's immune system reacts to milk and actually ultimately destroys the own islets of Langerhans that exist in the pancreas that produce insulin.
And what percentage of our children have type 1 diabetes?
It's a small percentage of children that have it, but of those that have it, a large percentage are influenced by the exposure to milk. Dairy products are perhaps the most antigenic substance that we feed our children, and much of the otitis media and many of the other conditions of childhood are aggravated by exposure to dairy products. And so by eliminating dairy products, you also eliminate a lot of the conditions that are associated with their consumption. And rather than encouraging it and providing federal subsidies for it, we should be educating people that this is a substance that a significant percentage of people need to completely avoid, and virtually everybody should be limiting regardless of their capacities.
Dr. Gerstle, do you want to add to that?
Yeah. You know, of the entire world's population, 75% is estimated to be lactose deficient.
How many?
75%.
Three-quarters of the people in the world are lactose intolerant?
Yes. In the United States, 25% of the white population, the Caucasian population, most of them which come from Southern European roots, is estimated to have lactose intolerance. And in the African American, Native American, and Asian American populations, prevalence is estimated to be about 75 to 90%. Now, the idea that these populations should all be consuming milk is getting at the real issue. And the real issue is that there's a lot of confusion in terms of government education, because government's spending money on trying to fight obesity and trying to fight all these health problems, but on the other hand, they're subsidizing the very things that cause these things.
We'll come to that later. That's a political question, but the subsidies. But in terms of health, what exactly does milk do to you that harms you?
Well, what happens with milk is when a baby drinks human milk, they're getting enough of the enzymes from their mother, enough of the antibacterial properties. Cow's milk is meant to turn a small calf into a 1,000-pound beast in a matter of a year. And so as a result of that, the milk is designed to have enough hormones to have a specific concentration of nutrients and minerals for that to happen.
And how much milk do grown cows drink?
How much milk do grown cows kill? I don't know exactly how
None.
Much.
No, I got this one of yours. Sorry, I'm cheating. But yeah. Obviously, grown cows don't drink any milk. When do calves stop drinking milk? How old are they usually? 6-7 weeks?
I'm not sure. They usually stop drinking it when they, you know, when they start weaning. Now, most humans, they stop drinking milk. You know, they're recommended to stop drinking milk about 6 months.
Well, baby humans. You mean nursing
yeah,
infants.
Yes.
But now, obviously in this country, many, many, many millions of adults drink milk. I mean, I actually lived on an organic farm for many years, and we milked the cows, and in retrospect, it was kind of disgusting, actually. But nonetheless, I mean, I used to drink milk right out of the pail.
If you think about it, we're the only species in the world that, number one, drinks milk past our weaning period, and number two, drinks that milk from another species of animals.
And you guys are saying it's detrimental. I haven't drunk milk since 1984, so...
The FDA works hard to protect us. They limit the amount of pus in milk to no more than 750,000 pus cells per cc. So, and of course, the average milk only has about half that much pus in it. So if you think about it, drinking milk is kind of like finding a cow with a festering wound and sticking your mouth on it and sucking.
And just to let your listeners know how much 750,000 pus cells per cc is, in 1982, the Canadian Veterinary Journal said that it suggested that thresholds of 300,000 cells per milliliter are used to identify infected quarters in cows, respectively. This is clearly not something that is being protecting the public.
Well, we are at the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We're talking with Drs. Alan Goldhammer and Nathan Gershfeld at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California. We're going through the systematically going through the details of the benefits of a vegan diet. And I am here by way of disclosure at the Santa Rosa at the health clinic. This is the 17th day of a 16-day water fast. In other words, this morning I had a glass of watermelon and celery juice, the first non-water ingestion I've had other than air since I don't know, early April, I guess. And I feel great. My weight in in June actually was 193, and I now weigh 148. If I was a foot shorter, I'd look like Gandhi. We're talking with two really, really great doctors discussing milk here, and drinking it. I highly recommend, as do they, that we not do that. What do you guys think of cheese? Where does cheese stand in the pecking order of
unhealthy
foods?
Well, you know, cheese
foods?
Is even better than milk in the sense it's coagulated cow pus, so now it's even more concentrated in the saturated fat and proteins and has an even higher concentration of the byproducts. So, you know, if you're really trying to see just what milk can do to you, eating cheese will be an even more efficient source of gaining the extra weight, creating the cardiovascular disease and contributing to the illnesses that, you know, often afflict people as a consequence of consuming these kind of processed products.
Well, is cheese worse than meat?
I'd have to say cheese, in my mind, would be number one. You know, I'd have to rate that as the most effective individual food for contributing to ill health that we know. But, it's a tough fight there with meat as well.
So you will not be bringing in a pepperoni pizza for lunch?
Probably not going to happen.
Okay. So let's proceed here. We have said that fish, of course, after Fukushima, I have been a big fish eater since coming here. But I was strictly limiting it, as a politically correct person would do, to wild-caught salmon, which most of which comes from the Pacific Northwest or the North Pacific. And since Fukushima, I don't think so. There are other reasons for not eating fish beyond nutritional stuff. Would you say, Dr. Goldhammer, that if someone is going to add animal products to their vegan diet, fish would be maybe the most reasonable?
No, I'd say that, you know, if you're wise enough to have adopted a vegan diet, the best thing to do would be to stick to a vegan diet. That the fact that something like fish may be somewhat less harmful overall than something else doesn't make it healthful. Something not being, you know, being less harmful does not make it healthful. So I'd recommend adopting a vegan SOS-free diet, because I'll tell you, Harvey, there's a bigger picture here. The hidden force that is undermining people's health and happiness is the fact that their brains are being stimulated artificially, whether it be by excess amounts of oil, whether it's excess amounts of sugar or other processed foods, into thinking that the foods that they're eating are normal and natural and healthy and health-promoting, and they're not. And so people are getting fatter and sicker by the day, and we're developing a society that is really going to be crushed under our own consumption of these highly processed food products. So whether it's the animal products and their biological concentration issues, or whether it's the highly processed food chemicals that we're adding to our foods that fool our brain satiety mechanisms and get us fat and sick and miserable, the whole thing has to stop. It doesn't do any good to start talking about moderation when you're talking about the fact that people are literally are eating ourselves to death.
Well, let's talk about this for a minute. Let's see if we can get in before the break. We're with Dr. Alan Gershfeld and Dr. Nathan Gershfeld and Dr. Alan Goldhammer here at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California. This is the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Dr. Goldhammer, tell us then, please, and in the second half of the hour, we'll get into the how a vegan diet helps people. Tell us what the state of the American health is related to diet, and then we'll talk about what a vegan diet can do for it. Well, let me, before we, you, tell us what the, please, do you have numbers that show that a vegan diet is better?
I think that Dr. Gershfeld has just shared with me some research that talks about these very issues. So why don't you go ahead and explain that, Dr. Gershfeld?
So how a vegan diet is better than an all-meat diet? Is that the question?
Please. Well, and any meat diet. I mean, you guys are hardliners here. You're telling us no meat, no dairy, no fish, no salt, no sugar, no oil. That's a lot of no's.
Let's take a step back here. Today in this country, a lot of people are worried about one thing, and that's quality of life and maybe living a little bit longer. And so what we do when we look at quality of life and living a little bit longer, we see what kind of people have a better quality of life and what kind of people live a little bit longer. And we look at the longest living societies on Earth, you look at all of their dietary patterns, their social patterns, their exercise patterns, and they are all plant-based. About 98% of their calories, 95 to 98, depending on which society, 95 to 98% of their calories come from plant foods.
Okay, let me jump in here real quick. Watching your lectures, you basically evaluate a diet based on, I mean, this is how you do it here at True North, evaluate a diet based on where calories come from. Is that correct, essentially? In other words, the ratios of your diet between fruit, nuts, meat, whatever else is in your diet, you scale them based on their calorie content.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. So I wanted to have that rule of thumb as we move ahead. So proceed, Doctor. Please tell us further what kind of numbers we have to show the vegan diet is superior.
So the kind of numbers we have to show that the vegan diet or the plant-based diet is superior to an animal or processed food diet is life expectancy numbers for those people who live longest. The longest living societies on Earth, along with the plant-based diet, have healthy lifestyles. They have diet, sleep, and exercise all together. They have a supportive social structure. And so we try to mirror that as much as possible. But more importantly, we have people that come into the center with serious diseases. Things like high blood pressure, which is the most significant risk factor for heart disease and alcohol. Things like diabetes, things like autoimmune diseases. And when you look at the data, it shows that most people who get on a plant-based diet can reverse a lot of these things and can really significantly impact them. Now, from a practical perspective...
And you have numbers to show that.
Oh, yeah. We published an article in Journal of Manipulative on Physiological Therapeutics, and we showed that 174 consecutive patients who had high blood pressure were able to, first of all, normalize their blood pressure, and all the 6% of the population that was on the blood pressure medications were able to get off of it. Now, just to give you an idea of the difference between what we did and what medications do, medications decrease blood pressure by about 12 points, 12 over 6 points. We did about 60 over 13.
Well, okay. My producer, Matt, his blood pressure is starting to rise a little bit. We're going to take a break here. We're at True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California, talking with Dr. Alan Goldhammer and Dr. Nathan Gersfeld about a vegan diet, its benefits, and the detriments of the health detriments of animal foods, as well as sugar, oil, and salt. That we're going to hear my friend Dana Lyons, who has the fabulous video on cows with guns, which I hope you guys have seen, and we will be right back after the break. Green Power Wellness Show. That was the great Dana Lyons singing the Silvertopia Rocky Top version. Dana has a magnificent, very, very funny YouTube. I think it's had over 2 million views now. Cows with Guns, a cartoon, become kind of the anthem of the vegetarian movement. We have been graced by the presence of Dr. Alan Goldhammer, a founder of the True North Health Clinic here in Santa Rosa, California, where I am. And we are joined here by Dr. Nathan Gersfeld to continue our discussion of a vegan diet And in the first half hour, we talked at great length about the problems with meat, fish, and dairy. We had a request to not say the word PUS anymore. So, Dr. Gershfeld, if you can avoid that one, please, we'd appreciate it. We're discussing, Dr. Gershfeld, before the break, the epidemiological, the scientific proof, if any, that a vegan diet is superior. You here at the True North Health Clinic have food that is free of salt, sugar, oil, and of course is completely free of animal products. And we want to know what proof do you have that this is better for people?
I'm going to go back. I heard you say that there might be epidemiological proof that the vegan diet is superior. And I'm going to go back. I don't think that there is as much vegan diet data that the vegan diet is superior to, say, a health-promoting diet that just doesn't have salt, sugar, oil, flour, and dairy in it. Now, when I was talking about the longest-living societies on Earth, now keep in mind, none of them are 100% vegan. But when we look at what they eat, they are plant-based. So they are pretty much vegan, and usually because it's due to scarcity. They don't have enough resources to eat the quantities of animal products that we do here.
Well, who are you saying they? Who is they?
There's five longest-living societies on Earth that so far have been studied to a great extent. Number one is Campidolimi, Italy. Number two is Bama, China. Three is Semar, Greece. Four is Hunza, Pakistan. And we all know about Okinawa, Japan.
Now, what do we know?
Sorry?
What do we know about Okinawa, Japan?
Well, Okinawa has been in the news for a long time for having long-living societies, for having a great percentage of octogenarians, people who live about 80, you know, who live more than 80 years old, the super centenarians, people who live over 110 years old. So Japan has been known in the news recently. Now there is an epidemic that is decreasing this because, especially in Japan, they're having, you know, the next generation is having a lot more access to processed foods. And so when we talk about whether, you know, a vegan diet is superior, it's mostly what we're talking about is a health-promoting diet. And that's what I want the listeners to understand, is it's a health-promoting diet. You can eat a vegan diet that's unhealthy. All you have to do is avoid animal products and dairy and just eat a bunch of chips and cookies and junk foods. So the underlying message is not so much to try and label what kind of a diet you're trying to eat, it's to eat a generally healthy diet. And so far from the data that we found, and anecdotal data, and looking at what the longest living societies have, it's foods that avoid salt, sugar, and oil, processed foods, dairy, and sticking with a plant-based diet. Lots of fruits, lots of vegetables, lots of steamed vegetables, lots of grains, and lots of beans, legumes, nuts, and seeds.
Well, before the break, we were saying basically that, what did you say, two-thirds of the American public is overweight.
Yes.
How can the vegan diet help that?
The vegan diet, a health-promoting diet that is largely plant-based, can help that because we have foods today in our food supply that are very calorie-dense. And what calorie-dense means is that you can fit a lot of calories into a very small amount of space. And so if I have something like oil, which is 120 calories per tablespoon,
Does that include olive oil, which everybody thinks is so healthy?
Any type of olive oil, any type of oil. We're talking about calories here. If we're talking about weight, we're going to talk about calories, not necessarily what type of fats.
I see. So I assume that includes motor oil as well.
We're talking about the fat content. Yeah, calorie foods that are edible. But going back to calorie density, foods that like chemicals like oil are added to our foods to increase calorie density. And so if I have a tablespoon of oil, that represents 120 calories. Now let's say I want to get
sesame oil, olive oil.
It doesn't matter what kind of oil you use. If it's edible, it's 120 calories per tablespoon.
Really? There's no difference in the various kinds of oils?
Absolutely no difference. There's different types of fats in the oils, but there's absolutely no difference from a calorie standpoint.
Are any of the fats in any of the oils beneficial?
There are some properties in the oil that happen to be beneficial, but it's much healthier just to eat the whole plant.
So olive oil does not fight heart disease, is that what you're saying?
it doesn't fight heart disease to the extent that some other things do. Red wine has shown to have a little bit of heart disease decreasing, but it increases all-cause mortality from liver cancer because you're drinking alcohol. So olive oil, yeah, it may fight a little bit of heart disease, but it's also contributing to obesity because of the extra calories. So you know, what we want to get away from is making, you know, trying to assume that the parts are greater than the whole, and if we can explain all the parts, then we've got the whole.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what all these studies do, is they say, well, let's take a piece of the puzzle, something like olive oil, and say, well, let's see how it affects heart disease, instead of taking a whole food and see how it affects all-cause mortality. My thing is, when you look at studies to see, oh, well, it decreased a little bit of heart disease, oh, well, it decreased a little bit of cancer, see what it does to the all-cause mortality, things that people die from, generally speaking. And it turns out plant-based diet and lots of the fruits and vegetables decrease all-cause mortality.
All right, say that again. Plant-based diet decreases all forms of mortality. People who eat, what you're saying is that people who eat a plant-based diet, mm-hmm. without meat, without fish, without chicken, without
plant-based
salt, without oil,
meat.
Without sugar, live longer?
Yeah. Plant-based diets decrease all-cause mortality from diseases like heart disease, things like heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity. Now, there's
okay.
very much data to show that a vegan diet, say like a 100% vegan diet compared to, you know, a 95% plant-based diet. But so that's why we're talking about plant-based.
I see.
Most people,
okay.
And salt, sugar, and oil-free. See, most people enjoy meat and they say they're carnivores, but what they're really enjoying is the salt or the teriyaki sauce or some of the other stuff that's put on there to stimulate your taste buds. And the reason is because things like salt, sugar, and oil, they stimulate your taste buds to artificially improve the taste of foods. And so if you can eat, you know, most people are not going to overeat on boiled beef or steamed chicken. It's just not as tasty. And most people will try that. If you sit down today for your lunch or your, and don't put any salt, make sure there's no salt, sugar, or oil or flour in there, you know, chances are it's not going to taste very good. You're not going to be able to eat very much of it. It's going to taste too bland.
Wow. Okay. We are on with Dr. Nathan Gershfeld at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California, where, by way of disclosure, I have just completed a 16-day water fast. I didn't have anything to eat and drank only water for 16 days. Last June, I weighed 193 pounds. I dropped to 173 when I gave up all meat, sugar, dairy. I'm sorry, when I gave up all sugar, I gave up meat and dairy back in the 70s and 80s. My weight was about 173 when I came here, and now it's 148. So Dr. Gershfeld, you cited five places in this world where people are very healthy, and it's linked to a vegan diet.
It's linked to a number of factors, not the least of which is a plant-based diet.
A plant-based
diet. Again, we're trying to do a whole type of, and part a big approach of it is diet. Now, national cancer statistics show that a diet is actually about a third related to the amount of cancer that we can get. The other third is cigarettes, and the other third is things like environmental, genetics, things like that. So to the extent that it's only a vegan diet, I don't want to misrepresent what that's about. Those long-living societies have a lot of things that they do in common.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, that's pretty significant. Are you saying that people who eat a vegan diet are one-third less likely to get cancer?
No. I'm saying that the National Cancer Institute published a paper about 2008 that cited the different causes of cancer. And one-third had to do with dietary factors, like eating not enough fruits and vegetables and whole grains. One-third had to do with tobacco and smoking, things like lung cancer. And the other third had to do with environmental factors, being exposed to chemicals, being exposed to having a genetic structure, and things that they, little things here and there that they can that they are studying separately. But one
well,
third.
Tell me exactly how much more likely is a person who has a meat and dairy diet to get cancer than someone who doesn't?
We have not studied that yet. That's very difficult to say. Because what we'd have to do is take people and put them on a known, you know, and actually not do anything once they have cancer. But we have found, you know, Dr. Ornish did a study not regarding with prostate cancer, and he found that gene expression in men undergoing an intensive nutritional lifestyle intervention, which was a plant-based diet,
mm-hmm.
actually changed their genes. They changed their molecular response to prostate cancer.
Hmm.
And this was published in this was published in 2008.
Okay.
By Dean Ornish.
In the 15 minutes we have left, it's Dean Ornish, and he's a very well-known and well-respected diet doctor. I guess millions of people have done the Ornish diet. What do you think of the Ornish diet?
I'm sorry?
What do you think of the Ornish plan?
I think it was great. It got, you know, he did one of the first studies that was able to reverse heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that doing a largely plant-based diet. And with meditation and things like, you know, things that he thought would play a role, like meditation classes. And he was the first one to show that you can actually reverse heart disease. And he did that by taking pictures of arteries. And they had people in a control group. And the control group followed the guidelines of the cholesterol education programs.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually got worse, and his group got better.
Okay. We are on with Dr. Nathan Gershfeld here at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California, talking about a vegan diet. Tell us what you do here, please. Tell us what the drill is here at the True North.
Well, what we do here is we educate people on how to live healthfully and how to manage any type of conditions. Now, going back, you had asked me how can a vegan diet help people lose weight. And the answer is, I was talking about the calorie density of a tablespoon of oil, and that it's 120 calories per tablespoon of oil. Now, just to compare that to 120 calories worth of fruits and vegetables, that's about a pound of fruits and vegetables. So,
versus
the question,
how much weight of oil?
This is, oil is 120 calories, and 1 pound of vegetables about 100 calories. So if you consider what people overeat on and what they can overeat on, it turns out that if you're eating a lot of these calories, namely oil, it's a lot easier to lose weight, it's a lot easier to gain weight on these things. And so when people are specifically trying to lose weight, we really try to minimize salt, sugar, and oil, because that way they can eat as much as they want, and they don't get full, and they can decrease their weight.
So do people go hungry on a vegan diet here? If you want to lose weight and you decide to go strictly vegan, how hungry are you going to get?
It's hard to say. That's hard to quantify how hungry you're going to get. What we try to promote is eating when you're hungry and stop eating when you're full. And so because a lot of our food here is not very calorie dense, which means you can't fit very many calories and it's a huge volume of food,
uh-huh.
you can eat as much as you want usually, and it doesn't result in extra weight gain. So if I'm eating 5 pounds of salad and steamed vegetables all day, that represents about 500 to 600 calories. So if you're eating 5 pounds of salad, I challenge anybody to try to eat 5 pounds of raw or steamed vegetables all day. You probably won't be able to shove it in there, and it's going to result in being full, getting enough nutrients, but also not getting a lot of calories. So if you're trying to lose weight, that would certainly be an excellent strategy, to just shove as many fruits and vegetables in your stomach as possible, with, you know, being favored with favoring, of course, the vegetables, which are less calorie dense. Understand that raw vegetables and steamed vegetables make up about 100 calories per pound. That means that for every pound of vegetables, you're eating 100 calories. Now, fruits, on one hand, are about 300 calories per pound. And your brain knows the difference, because the more calories per pound you have in a food, your brain can detect which foods are more calorie dense, because it produces a chemical called dopamine. And it makes food a little bit more pleasurable. And so when I look at salad and then I look at fruits, which is going to taste better to you? It's going to be probably fruits. And so we look at the next scale, got potatoes and starches. They're about 500 calories per pound. And they, of course, taste a lot better than salad, which is 5 times less concentrated. We go upwards to things like chocolate and ice cream and meat and oil and fried foods. And we can understand that the more concentrated they are, the more pleasurable they are to our brains. And that's why we prefer those foods to things like salad and fruits and vegetables. And so when people overeat, when they get overweight, when they eat things that compromise their health, this is why. It's because they're caught in this dichotomy of foods being pleasurable, but on the other hand, they're unhealthy. And this is what we call the pleasure trap. And so coming to this center, we try to educate people to get off this destructive pattern. And we get off this destructive pattern by, number one, training them to eat healthier foods and understanding that it takes a little bit of time to adapt your taste buds to enjoy foods that are less calorie concentrated. And most people, when they change their diets, they change their diet, they eat some bland food, they say, oh, you know what, I could never live like this. It's worth it to die earlier than to eat this bland food. But the thing is, the reason most people say that is because they are not aware that this discomfort only lasts a couple of months. And then what? And then the taste buds change. They get adapted to the low-calorie food and the low-concentrated food and the low-salt and the low-sugar and the low-oil food. And they start to the foods start to taste just as good as the high stimulating foods. I'm telling you is, if you preferred something like salted popcorn with a lot of butter at the movie theater, uh-huh, and you were gaining a lot of weight and getting a lot of heart disease and a lot of problems because of this and high blood pressure, and you came to the center, after a few weeks of eating this program, you would go back and eat popcorn and it would taste too stimulating. It would be too much. And you could probably cook some popcorn yourself without any oil, without any salt, and it would taste marvelous. And the reason would be because your taste buds have now acclimated. They have gotten sensitive. I'll give you an example as to where else this happens in our body. Let's say you're in a room indoors and it's nicely lighted, and then you go outside into the bright sunlight. What's going to happen is your eyes are going to squint because it's too bright. But then, after a few minutes, your eyes are going to acclimate, and then you'll be able to open your eyes again. And then let's say you go from that bright sun back into your room. Now it's going to look dark, and your eyes are going to look like it's very dark. And the reason that's happening is because your brain is adapting. It's called neuroadaptation. Your brain is adapting to different sensory stimulus. And so the same thing happens in every sensory organ in our body, not just our eyes, but our taste buds. So when your taste buds eat something that's very, very stimulating, it feels stimulating at first, and then you get used to it. And so when you're a kid and you're a baby or you're a mother or father and you feed your child something like salt, sugar, oil, something very stimulating, at first it's very uncomfortable. It's a little bit too much, just like you're turning up the radio a little bit too loud. But then you get used to it, and then you need a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more just to maintain that sense of stimulation. But when you decrease it, when you try to get foods without salt, sugar, and oil, it tastes really bland, kind of like, you know, there's nothing there. But after a while, your taste buds acclimate. They readapt to the new level of stimulation, and it starts to be just about the same as the other stimulation. And so what we do here is we help people along that process and reassure them, and we teach them how to do it here, and then we teach them how to do it at home. And so a lot of the times people come here and they don't like the food, it's a little bit bland, but then they start to realize that the food, they actually can taste the food, it tastes a lot better. And they really get to a point where they add the salt, they don't need to add the oil, they don't need to add the sugar or the flour or the dairy to make foods taste better, because they're good just as they are.
All right, we have, Nathan, only 7 minutes left. So tell us, please, what your ideal diet is. We've said that 66% of the American public is overweight. Of course, we all know that billions of dollars are spent on diet plans. You have argued that a vegan diet will reliably drop your weight and enhance your health. Tell us, please, what kind of food people eat here at the True North Health Clinic, and how the diet is regimented, and what you would recommend for people in the larger society.
A typical health-promoting diet includes extreme amounts of fruits and vegetables, in the sense that a typical breakfast might be a large bowl of oatmeal, a large bowl of some sort of whole grain, some fruits, and some salad. Some lunch can be a big, huge salad, a big, huge plate of steamed vegetables. And when I say big, I don't mean like a little plate. I mean like a huge plate. Remember, these things are not...
Well, basically a trough. You tie people's hands behind their back, and then they eat, you know, just like cows.
Is that when you go outside, you know, and you're eating outside, the way to tell if your salad is big enough is if your friends come up to you and they're shocked, and if they say, hey, you know what? Oh, my God, are you going to eat that whole salad? If they don't say that, chances are your salad isn't big enough.
Okay.
So what we're doing here is to follow your instincts as to what foods you prefer, but to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, a lot of unprocessed foods. The idea is it's painful enough as it is to try to live in an unhealthy world, but to count calories and to sit there and count portion sizes, it's ridiculous and it's unnecessary. What you should be doing is eating as much vegetable, a lot of raw vegetables, steamed vegetables, and then a certain amount of conservatively cooked starches. And what I mean by conservatively cooked starches, I mean like brown rice, sweet potatoes, black beans, you know, some type of beans, with some fruits occasionally and some occasional amounts of nuts or seeds. And that's a simple way to get as many nutrients as you can and get it, you know, not worry about the amount of calories you're getting.
Well, so you don't believe in limiting quantity, is that correct?
If you're eating a whole natural diet with unprocessed foods and most of it comes from plant-based materials, you don't need to limit the quantity of food.
Well, you're not saying most, you're saying all. You're saying all of it should come from plant-based foods.
Oh, yeah. If you're eating a vegan diet, yes. And just make sure to test your vitamin B12 every year or so just to double-check you're getting enough.
Yes. Now, what about protein? Everybody worries about getting enough protein.
You know, the protein myth is interesting that you bring it up. Now, you know, in the thing is, in 1955, Dr. William Rose and Robert Wicksum, they studied the amino acid requirements of a man. And why I say amino acid is amino acid is what makes up a protein. There's several amino acids that make up a protein. And they were actually trying to find how much exactly do we need just to survive, just to maintain an equilibrium. And what equilibrium would mean is how much do I need to eat so that I don't urinate any extra out and I don't need any extra more. And what they found is that we need significantly less protein than what were suggested. And what they found that most people need about 3.5 grams per day. Now that's the absolute bare minimum to just have an equilibrium. And so today the recommendation is to eat significantly more than 3.5 grams per day. And so when we're talking about protein, we really have to worry about excess protein. And excess protein causes many, many more diseases than not enough protein. So excess protein can result in things like gout, kidney disease, high blood pressure, even things like colon cancer and liver cancer. And so the idea of worrying about a deficiency in protein is just not accurate. We do not have data today to understand what the protein deficiency is of vegetarians in North America. And the reason we don't have it is because it's largely non-existent. Protein deficiency occurs in countries, third world countries, where they don't have enough calories. And so the idea that vegetarians somehow don't get enough protein is just not founded in data, in scientific data. Now, most people associate protein with meat, and that's largely due to marketing. You know, when someone says milk, you see them. When someone says orange juice, they right away think of vitamin C. And so, you know, a lot of these things.
So, Nathan, actually, Dr. Gershfeld, we're actually running out of time. We're talking with Nathan Gershfeld at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California. I am coming off a 16-day water fast and have my first juice this morning. And we're going to wrap up the show so I can go have another one. This has been the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. And to sum up, Dr. Gershfeld, you're saying a vegan diet is healthier, that people can lose weight on it and not go hungry, and all will be well. We didn't even get into the politics of meat and cheese and dairy and fish, so I'm going to have to kind of have you, Dr. Gershfeld and Dr. Alan Goldhammer, back on the show, if that's all right with you, and we can talk about the politics of our food and our meat. This has been, thank you very much, Dr. Gershfeld.
Thank you very much.
Appreciated. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I do want to again mention that the great and truly wonderful Chick Callenbach, author of Soul Equitopia, has passed away. You can see him with me on the HarveyWasserman.ning.com website. I have a wonderful one-hour talk with him. I miss him tremendously. He was a great guy. And let's all hear it for a vegan diet. And we will be back next week with more from the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. This has been Harvey Wasserman, and take care, and don't eat that cow. Into the ground, it started to burn many things we found, but don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia.
Solartopia, Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.